Welcome, everyone, to another edition of Open Air. I'm Kevin Vance, sitting in for David LaTulipe this afternoon. We have pianos, we have comedy, we have film. What more can you want on an arts program? Welcome to a number of people coming up during this hour. We'll have Susan Louise Connor. She's going to be playing Edith in Blithe Spirit, as performed on Broadway. She's performing that here in San Francisco. We also will have Christopher Tocco, he's going to be playing the part of Richard Greenblatt in a performance of Two Pianos, Four Hands in Mountain View. Our critic at large, Peter Robinson, will begin to talk about an American sniper film as well as the Mostly British Film Festival. I would like to welcome to the KLW studio, to the microphone here, Dan Demers. Good to see you again.
Welcome, nice to see you.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
He's working on a project. It is one of my favorite musical biopics, but it's not really a pick. It's the actual play, Amadeus.
Yes, yes.
And, of course, when I think of Amadeus, I think of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And here is a stage play version of the rivalry between Mozart, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart and Antonio Salieri.
Yes.
So how much of this is going to be the film, and what's different from the film?
Well, you know, what's interesting is this play by Peter Schaefer, it won a Tony Award and an Academy Award together. There are moments within the play that don't exist in the film, but they follow the same line fairly closely. It's a beautiful, as you said, a beautiful tale that explores the relationship between Antonio Salieri and Mozart. And what's interesting, or I find interesting, with the play version versus the film can take you, you know, from one scene to another scene to another scene, which is gorgeous. But in the stage version, you're going to see people changing costumes and aging right in front of your eyes.
Oh, how interesting.
Because there's no, that convention in film that's just so beautiful, you don't have that in live theater. You have to do it in front of everyone's face. So it creates a whole new layer and dynamic beauty to this play.
Oh, that's amazing. Now, it's musical. Will there be piano playing on stage as well?
Yes.
Uh-huh. The real thing. No, nothing canned.
Some of it is canned, yes, and some of it will be close to real, yeah.
Oh, tell me about the live stuff.
I say close to real.
Is it live or is it Memorex?
Right. It's a little bit of both.
Who remembers that one?
My amazing build crew has built this beautiful set, and on the set is a replica of the actual piano. The name escapes me at the moment, but it's a replica.
It was an early version. It was the forte piano.
Thank you. Forte piano. In my head, I'm saying harpsichord. Nope, that's not it.
Post-harpsichord.
Yeah, it's a forte piano, and our designer, Guajalo, who's brilliant, has created this masterpiece to match Mozart's music, and it's just arches and pianos and fabric, and he's painting today, I believe he's painting frescoes on the wall, so it's just it's going to have the same sort of elaborate beauty and masterfulness that we've seen before in the film.
How hard or how easy was it to distinguish between the play and the movie? Was there a sort of disconnect? Was there a lot of work? What does one have? I imagine thinking of plays adapted for movies,
mm-hmm.
that they're completely different animals.
Correct.
Was this a different animal? These were different animals.
Oh, yes, very different.
One won the play award, one won the film award.
Correct.
What will we see that's different? You probably...
Well, there's going to be... obviously, the actors are going to be different.
Of course.
But
he won't be... The guy playing Mozart won't be playing at all manic like Sid Vicious or anything.
No. The gentleman who's playing Mozart, Ross Neuenfeld, he was last seen in 39 Steps earlier this year.
Mm.
He's a brilliant performer, and what is so beautiful about him and his performance is that he really takes Mozart to a different level. So it's not that wild, and I mean, he's wild and crazy, but there was some of this in the film. There was no, the peaks and valleys of the character were not as deep and high. And what Ross is doing is he's really creating this beautiful character with very high peaks and very low valleys. So you really feel this emotional connection to this character who is not as present in the play as he is in the film.
A little manic?
A little man, of course. It's Mozart.
Just a little
yeah.
manic?
Oh, yeah. There's, you know, manic and running around and sex and, you know, it's Mozart.
How about Salieri? How has he played? Is he resentful and does he have steam coming out of his
Jerry
ears?
Lloyd is playing Salieri. He's a brilliant performer. He is, you know, we had a discussion last night about the character because he really is the pole in the middle of a violent storm.
And, I would imagine.
And so we, you know, he's on stage for 90 minutes and then he gets a 15-minute break and he comes back on for 90 minutes and he doesn't leave at all. He's on stage the whole time and he weaves the tale together and you know, his history and his memories come to life, which craft the story, which you see briefly in the film, but in the play, it's very predominant. And, he has created a Salieri that is just gorgeous and has so many dynamic levels. And it's interesting because what he's done is he makes you fall in love with him in Act One, and then in Act Two, you can't stand the look at him. And it's just this beautiful, you know, contradiction. So he's really doing an amazing job.
Oh, I was going to – I wondered because I remembered the movie just hating – thinking, oh, I'm being set up to hate Salieri here. But we get to have all the whole emotional range on this one.
Yes, on this one. In the play version, because he's the quote-unquote narrator or the weaver of the tale, you really fall for him and you feel bad in the beginning. And then Act Two occurs when everything shifts – that you think, no, I don't like him anymore. I want to go back to Act One. It's more fun.
His name is Dan Demers. He is one of the major forces behind the scenes, the executive artistic director at the Hilborn Theater, presenting Peter Schaeffer's Tony Award-winning play Amadeus, the great story about Mozart and Salieri. Was the rivalry for real, or was this just a story that was created for?
It was based on truth.
It was based
it
on
was
truth.
Based
so they
on
were
truth.
Rivals.
Yeah,
then.
There's of course. With anything that's written, there's a level of embellishment, but it was based on some truth, yes.
Okay. Hilborn Theater is in Foster City. The address is 1285 East Hillsdale Boulevard. You're opening tonight. Oh, my
yes,
God.
Yes, preview tonight and grand opening tomorrow.
Oh, my God. And it's going to run to February 8th
yep.
as well. So what's it like? You're a person who's on the stage, you're in the spotlight, but you're also one who knows how to operate the spotlight too.
Yeah.
Yeah. tell me what you're doing behind the scenes besides talking on the radio about it.
Well, okay, so for this one, we've been working. The biggest challenge obviously has been costumes and wigs and all that period stuff of the 18th century. So each show I try and, you know, help out where I can and be a presence where I can. So for this show, I'm actually helping with wigs. And so we're all in the back just doing these wigs and it's a lot of fun and everyone's cracking up. And, you know, when you finish the picture, it's just beautiful. It's breathtaking. So, you know, when you're behind the scenes, there's a certain beauty to watching the creation come from the page to the stage. But when you're in it, there's a sort of humbling nature that what you create is given to the audience, and then they have that experience of watching that come to life. So it's a beautiful experience on both sides of the table.
Mm. Well, this play, this performance at the Hilborn Theater in Foster City, it's part of a series called A Season of Awakening. Tell me about A Season of Awakening. Does that mean you've got some very awakening-like plays lined up in this?
Yeah, so I designed the season around the word awakening because I wanted to explore the human experience and what it means, you know, during our journey. Last year was a season of truth, and so I wanted to bridge that with this idea of awakening, that once you realize your truth or your discovery, you're awoken to an ideal, a motive, a direction, a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
So each show is designed around that idea that the main character or characters within that show will have this awakening and realize their journey or their purpose throughout the show. And so for me, Amadeus was kind of a pivotal point to that concept, because you have a man who has, you know, dedicated his life to God and music, and all of a sudden this young giggling idiot walks in and just destroys his reality. And then he's faced with the truth and a new path of that he himself imposes of destroying this man and becoming famous.
Mm.
So it's this beautiful, you know, play on awakening for both Mozart and for Salieri, because Mozart is awoken to the reality that even though he has these brilliant ideas and he thinks he's the best of the best, he can't fit. His puzzle piece doesn't fit into this mold of you know, royalty and Italian opera.
Oh, God. I'm looking forward to this. This sounds like a fantastic...
Thank you.
And is it a series of plays that... Or is the Season of Awakening just that one play, this one play that you're doing?
No, we're doing six. We do six shows a year.
I'd love to know what they are.
We opened with Funny Girl, and then we did 39 Steps.
Yeah.
And then for the holidays, we did White Christmas, Irving Berlin's White Christmas. We have Amadeus right now. The next show we're doing is Proof. Which one is that? That's the story about a young woman who's a mathematician and her relationship with her father. Was also a film, a beautiful, beautiful show.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're closing the season with Curtains.
Oh, tell me about Curtains.
So Curtains is a madcap murder mystery musical. Say that five times fast. And then it's about a Boston police officer who comes in because there's been a murder on stage, and he spends the length of the show, the time, trying to figure out who did it, while at the same time discovering that his true calling in life is not to be a detective, but to be a performer. So it's a wild, zany comedy of a show that, again, explores purpose and meaning. So it's great.
The Hilburn Theater is located at 1285 East Hillsdale Boulevard in Foster City. A preview tonight. People are invited to attend the preview
tonight. Yes, they are.
Excellent. And it runs, what, Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays?
Thursdays through Sundays.
Thursdays through Sundays.
Yeah, and Sundays the matinee at 2 o'clock.
Ooh, good. Oh, good.
It's just in time for dinner after
let's
you talk
hear,
about it.
Let's hear it for matinees. And it runs till the 8th of February. Can you give me a website or a phone number?
Sure. It's www.hilbarntheater.org, and theater is R-E at the end.
R-E at the end.
Yes.
That's the way it should be spelled.
Yes, traditional.
Right.
Yes.
Dan Demers, good to see you again.
Good to see you, too. Thank you so much.
Don't be a stranger. Come back and let us know what else you're working on, okay?
Will do. Thank you so much. Take care.
A little bit from the overture of Don Giovanni, one of the many pieces that will be featured in that performance of the great play Amadeus at the Hilbarn Theater, opening tonight and running through to February 8th. Hilbarn Theater in Foster City on Hillsdale Boulevard. Go ahead and Google that. It is open air. My name is Kevin Vance, sitting in for David Law Tulip. I have the pleasure of welcoming now to the KALW microphones Susan Louise Connor. She is playing the part of Edith in a performance of the Noel Coward play Blythe Spirit. I only wish that our colleague who loves Noel Coward, Alan Farley, were here, because he loved Noel Coward, and he would probably think of even much better questions than I would.
I don't know. Don't sell yourself short.
But I'm looking forward to hearing about your performance. Now, tell us the story here. What's going on in Blythe Spirit?
See, this is the trick of Blythe Spirit, is a good bit of the story is a giveaway. But I can tell you it's an improbable farce by Noel Coward, the famous Noel Coward. And it's about ghosts and manners and witty surprises. I can't tell you a whole much more plot point because it'll ruin it for you.
But
have to come.
But the feeling that I get from doing a little research about this is it's a bunch of rich, stuck up. Pardon my American my American sensibilities, but a bunch of British upper crust stuck up types who don't know any better, who are trying to get in spirits. And what's your part in all this?
But that is kind of the case. There's these two couples, and there's this one main couple, and the gentleman's trying to write a book, and so he wants to do some research on spirits, and so he invites Angela Lansbury's character, Madame.
Angela Lansbury?
You didn't know Angela Lansbury was in it? Oh.
That is so cool. She's coming to this.
She is in this show right now doing an amazing work, as she did on Broadway and in the West End. She plays Madame Arcati, who is a medium. And so they invite her over under the pretense of having a seance. But then spirits are released. And so Angela and I come from a different world, and these upper crust folks, as you say, that are trying to dabble in the spirit world. And yeah, you have to come see Angela Lansbury, yeah.
What is it like working with her? Isn't she like kind of royalty?
She is absolutely royalty. I always say she's comic genius. She can, watching her, the way that she's able to build a laugh technically, and the way that she constructs things, and her relationship with the audience and the moment-to-moment work that she does, it is really a masterclass. And she's also the classiest woman I know. Handwritten thank you notes for everything. I gave the woman a bag of cookies. I got a handwritten thank you note.
Whoa.
Yeah, she rolls like that. So everyone's game is upped, you know. She's
How do you keep up with something like that?
Oh, you just stand back and watch and try to be 10% as cool. I think you don't try to keep up. I think she's in the front, and you just hope to stay in the dreads.
Ah, so this sounds like an entire cast of characters,
yeah.
not just the maid. Now you're the maid.
I'm the maid, and you never underestimate the maid in a Noel Coward play.
Oh,
because
no,
the maid always has something either very funny to say or something very important to do. And in my case, I have some very important action, and that's all I can tell you.
Some very important action.
Yes.
How do you prepare for the very, without saying what the action is?
Well, the role is actually very physical. So there's a ton of physical comedy, at least in the way that we've created the role. And we've added some things in the Broadway show. They created some new things in the West End. So there's a lot of bits, as they say. And so there's a ton of stretching and a lot of yoga. And it's a lot, there's a lot of running. My character loves to run around the stage, a completely inept maid. So I drop things, I run around, I fall, I do all kinds of crazy things.
What did you pick this role, or did they give you this role?
Oh, for the days. No, I auditioned with 500 other women in New York City in 2009 to do the Broadway show. And then when they were taking it on tour, they called me and asked me if I'd like to do it again.
What's it like to do a Noel Coward play as opposed to doing television or doing voiceovers or doing other things?
Yeah. You know,
besides the fact that you're playing completely different characters.
Sure. But I always... this is something that it might be very American of me and my training, that I didn't go to any Ivy League kind of place. I'm kind of a school down the streets. But unless I understand it from the inside out, it doesn't work for me. I find a lot of joy in telling the story and truth. And if I'm lying or faking or just doing something and it doesn't come from inside, what's the point, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in that way, in that you're building a truth and trying to communicate something, they're all the same. In the way that Coward requires timing and precision in a different way than Shepherd might. That is something that you really do kind of have to align your beats or align your gestures even. There's a detail that you have to kind of draw those lines in very distinctly, and then you can play within them. But I would say that's the main difference.
Mm-hmm. Do you find yourself getting typecast as a character actor?
I will say I've been called in for a lot of maids.
Mm-hmm. Really? Interesting.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, I think I was a character actor, quote unquote, from very young. And that all has to do with maybe not being the model in the room. That said, I don't know. I think everybody likes someone they can relate to. And it's hard for me to relate to somebody that looks like a model and isn't flawed. So I like to think that maybe those models are the character actors and we're just the regular people.
That's what I think, too. That's what I like to think, too, because I see a lot of characters in real life.
Right? This is true. Everyone is, right?
Right. And sometimes the character actor is the most important person there because they're the ones who really, they're much deeper and they seem to have more.
Well, they have the permission to be flawed and to not be perfect, and you don't always have to be likable. And there's a release in the character parts that you're allowed to do that you don't get to do in the leading lady per se. So much more fun.
Mm-hmm. Right? It is much more fun.
And there's a lot more room for you to be you within the role then, because I'm certainly flawed. You know,
I can't tell.
In a wonderful way.
Of course, in a wonderful way. No, you remind me of about half a dozen of my friends who are just characters, and they, mm-hmm. you know, they think they're flawed, and they walk around with clouds over their heads, and I say, "No, you're not.
No,
come on.
It can be wonderful. Flaws are fantastic. That's what makes everybody, right?
Yeah.
I don't want to be friends with the perfect person.
Oh no, I don't even. I don't even know
what that would look like. Actually.
I don't know what a perfect person is like.
No,
I've given up trying to figure out what the perfect person.
They're probably terribly boring.
No, I remember being a frustrated actor in college, and I was the only one with a beard in high school, so I was always getting old man roles.
Sure. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah, it was.
Which could be great roles.
Oh, they're wonderful roles. They were great roles.
See?
I mean, some of them were real jerks. I love playing. is there a certain thrill in playing a bad guy as opposed to a good guy, or a bad girl as opposed to a good girl?
You know,
I see her. I see Edith as sort of both. You're a good girl and a bad girl.
Yes, exactly. And I think going back to how I approach everything, there is no. I don't like to label anything good or bad. But as long as it's rooted in a true want, then it's just what you're doing to get what you want. Now, somebody else might deem that as a good or bad move, but it's just what you want and how many people you're willing to step on to get it.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about, just going back to the story of the play, what was going on in this play premiered in 1941, and there was, the war was either happening in Europe or not yet happening in North America. What was is it a frozen in time period piece where you see what life is like in 1941, or is this something that could be played at any other time in history?
You know, what's been kind of amazing is that because at the root of Charles Edwards plays one of the lead characters, Mr. Condamine, and he has a wife, and he has a wife that has passed away, as a current wife. And at that root, it's about marriage, and it's about relationships, and it's a play about class. None of those things have anything to do with a particular time period. I find it to be very universal in its way. Oh, the marriage stuff, people really understand that. The laughter from the audience. Some sexes are laughing and some sexes are not. It's really fun. There's groan and they're like, ooh, yeah. No, it's fairly timeless that way.
Are you on tour with this company?
Yeah, we're doing a national tour of a play, which never happens anymore because economics, people don't do it. But we're doing four cities. I like to call it a mini tour. But mm-hmm. we just came from L.A., where we were for 9 weeks. We're here for 2 weeks. And then we go to Toronto in February. I expect it'll be very warm there.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Then we're going to D.C. to close it out.
Be nice and insulate, all that
snow. Oh,
yeah.
That's what someone told me. I was like, I'd love to go to balmy Toronto.
In February.
Oh, yes. That sounds perfect. What are you going to do?
I love it. Do you find that one joke works better than the other, or do you find different nights that you do a line and it works for one audience, and then the other night it's like, oh, that one didn't fly very well?
See, I've always come from camp number two, where it's always amorphous and it can always change. And what I found particularly about this show and the director, Michael Blakemore, who's a comic genius and he's been around forever, is that if you do it, like he told you, like you planned in the room, you will always hit it. Mm. And it's amazing. You're like, no, Michael, it depends. There's feelings. And sometimes if you turn your head on the second word instead of the third, the laugh will always be there.
Ah.
It's insane. And it isn't always. There are some jokes that do always land. It just depends on the amount of audience. It depends how, if you have those audience members with big, boisterous laughs that invite everyone else to laugh around them. But in general, it's kind of amazing how technical comedy can be sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a lot. Timing.
Really? I mean, and just this little detail stuff. And Angela's a master at it. Just this little stuff where you're like, oh, I looked on this phrase, and then I looked back, and no laugh, but I looked quicker, half a second quicker, and boom, there it is. Mm. It's a fantastic thing.
I'm looking forward to seeing the show.
I think you'll love it. She's amazing.
Susan Louise Connor, she's playing the part of Edith, the maid, in Blythe Spirit. And this is a show that's been on Broadway, and it's here in San Francisco, and it's on its way to Toronto, and then that's it.
And then D.C.
And then D.C., that's right, you said
yes,
D.C.
Yes, yes, yes.
And did you get a chance to be a tourist and look around San Francisco and get out of the theater?
I'm definitely starting that today. When we're done. We had two shows yesterday and we got here on Monday, so I did do a little exploring, and it's my first time in San Francisco, so it's quite the treat. I've never been here before.
Oh, you got to come here more often.
Yeah, it is a treat.
What other things are you working on these days?
I've been doing a lot of web series work, which people are
how
prone
is
to
that
do,
doing? Yeah, because I'm wondering if that's work lucrative for actors is to do
acting.
Oh,
I don't think the words lucrative and actor go really together.
I should know better.
Yeah, no, come on now. What it can be is very artistically fulfilling, you know, and you can reach a greater audience. I come from the not-for-profit theater world, and I consider the web series kind of the not-for-profit film world
in a way
that indie film hasn't been able to do anymore because of the way it kind of got eaten up by studios. So the web series is a way that you can put work out there. The trick is how to get through the flood of it. But I think there are possibilities there for creating work in a way that you can reach a different audience member.
One of those TV shows that everybody's watched but I haven't watched is called Orange is the New Black. I heard a rumor about you and Orange is the New Black.
Is that I'm on season 3 and it's the best show ever? Yes, I've heard that rumor as well.
Excellent.
I love that show. It films in New York, and I think it's a really wonderful show. And I had the pleasure of doing some work on it in season 3. Yeah.
So we're looking forward to seeing you on the big stage and the small screen
as
well.
Yes, exactly. And I'll take the big screen and the small stage too.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Whatever you got over there.
Yeah. Susan Louise Connor. O'Connor, thank you so much for coming in. Welcome
to
San Francisco. Stick around here and get a fog burn, you know. She's playing Edith in the play Blythe Spirit, the great comic play by Noel Coward, which is running now through the 1st of February at the SHN Golden Gate Theater. Angela Lansbury just happens to be one of your co-stars.
Yes, we allow her to come play with us occasionally.
Oh, gosh, this is so cool. It is the SHN Golden Gate Theater at 1 Taylor Street, downtown San Francisco. A website you can go to is shnsf.com. You can also go to blythespiritheplay.com. And Susan, good to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Thank you.
Yeah. That's the thing, right?
A little bit from Mozart's Requiem on the occasion that that's one of the pieces in the play about Mozart and Salieri that we heard from earlier on Open Air. I'm Kevin Vance sitting in for David LaTulipe this afternoon. Speaking of Mozart, speaking of music, we have another performance that involves music and play. Two very strong characters. I want to welcome to the KLW studio Christopher Tocco, who plays the part of Richard Greenblatt in a play called Two Pianos and Four Hands. It's a virtuoso comedy, and it comes from the pen of Ted Dykstra and Richard Greenblatt. It takes place at the Mountain View Center for the Performing Arts on 500 Castro Street at Mercy in Mountain View. Just opened a week ago on the 14th, and it's still showing, performing on all the way through to February the 8th of this year.
February 15th, actually.
February 15th? Oh, yeah, you got extended.
We just got extended, yeah.
Very cool. Very cool. So tell me the story of two hands and four, two pianos, four hands. Oh, boy. How embarrassing. Ted Dykstra. And tell me about Ted Dykstra.
Dykstra. Yeah.
Okay.
He has another horrible last name to pronounce, like my own.
Oh, you'd be surprised what people do with my last name. So tell me the story.
This is a semi-autobiographical piece, originally by Ted Dykstra and Richard Greenblatt, two Canadian actor, writer, performers. And it is their story of striving to achieve piano stardom from a very young age, and then finally reaching that point where they realized they were not going to be the next, Van Cliburn or Vladimir Horvitz or Glenn Gould, and coming up against their failures, essentially. So in this incarnation of the play, myself, Christopher Tocco, and my partner Darren Dunstan have taken over the roles of Ted and Richard. And we come out to initially play the first movement of Bach's D minor piano concerto, or written for two pianos. And we achieve an epic failure where we originate playing the wrong circle of fifths and we can't catch each other up and we just ultimately completely break down. And it gets to the point where we've actually forgotten how to play. And we're in front of the auditorium full of people. Mm-hmm. And from that point on, the story kind of becomes goes into a meta retelling, essentially, of their very first moments of learning how to play. And then the play progresses on from, teachers, and we each play each other's teachers and parents all the way up through high school, where we are at the point where we're auditioning for conservatories and that kind of thing.
Is it the actors, or are you changing costumes and becoming the parents and the teachers? or are you just being like both colleagues and you're kind of playing each other's roles?
I like to think of it more like that it's this exploration between these two colleagues who've, heard these stories, ad nauseum over the years from one another, and they kind of take turns, portraying each other's nightmare experiences, mm-hmm. Throughout learning to play the piano. All our props are anything that can fit inside the piano bench.
Okay.
So that's pretty much all we have, with a few minor exceptions. We come out wearing concert tails and we end the show wearing concert tails. So there's no wigs or quick costume changes or anything like that. Everything is, we try to indicate, switching a character by a quick gesture, or what's the identifying characteristic of a 10-year-old boy, or your 60-year-old Italian piano teacher, just quick little triggers for us to and for the audience to help follow the story, you know.
Mm-hmm. So are we seeing the two actors also playing piano?
Absolutely. There's no canned music.
None of the canned, no miming the piano or anything like that.
Not at all.
What came first, being an actor or being a pianist?
Professionally, I've only ever really been an actor, but I started playing the piano from the age of six. I'd like to say I've had a complicated relationship with the piano since
I would imagine. You've got to play. You've got to practice. You probably got tired of that.
Oh, sure. And that kind of story comes up, with that conversation with parents.
I just want to go out and play with the kids, you know?
Exactly. And this is a trope that I think anybody who ever intensely studied any kind of discipline can relate to, whether it's a musical instrument or, some type of sport or whatever.
Okay. but you fell in love with the piano and you stayed with it.
And I actually have a very similar story to Ted and Richard, who did end up quitting when they were, 17, 18 years old. And like Richard, I had studied classical music very intensely from an early age, and also been in, church choir and choir at school and that sort of thing. So classical music really infused my background. In fact, I remember when my parents first purchased a CD player and we got an album that had words on it, my brother and I were amazed because all we'd ever heard growing up were LPs, of classical music or opera. We didn't know they had words in English. You thought you had to listen to the radio. at some point became interested in jazz and like any young piano player, and wanted to start playing some pop music and that sort of thing. Played in the jazz band in high school. But just got to that point where we realized, that one kid, he's better than me. If he's better than me, that means there's somebody else better than him. And you talk yourself into circles into quitting because you don't see it, playing an instrument or pursuing your artistic dream as a viably professional career. It's not going to be something that's financially remunerative. And, you got your parents yammering at you that you got to go to college and get a degree and do something to help provide for your family. And you have society telling you that as well. And unfortunately, I feel like a lot of us, we listen to that voice so much that it turns us off completely from something that was initially a great joy of ours in life. And part of our mission, I think, with the show, and Richard Greenblatt likes to talk about this as well, is that it's about giving the music back to people. That classical music in particular is not something that just belongs to the elites. It's not something that just belongs to Horowitz and Glenn Gould and people who go to the symphony, at regular basis, but it really belongs to everybody. And if we don't embrace it and we don't take ownership over it, it's going to disappear, it will become more and more marginalized in our culture, in our society. And we're going to individually and personally miss out on that experience, that transcendent experience that music can bring to all of us.
I agree. I love it when it's played in small venues as well as large venues, that it is accessible to people and it's not flying way over people's heads. When you're not acting, what are you doing? Are you playing piano in a band or professionally in recital in any?
No, I actually I had not played piano publicly, except for a few minor occasions here and there, for almost 12 to 13 years until I started performing in two pianos, four hands.
No kidding. Whoa.
I had quit. I quit. That was it. And I didn't want to deal with it anymore.
You really did quit. Oh, my God.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, other than playing for friends here and there and, playing out in public a handful of times, I really hadn't touched it. In fact, my keyboard that I have in my apartment in New York City, had literally sat in my apartment for 2 years collecting dust. They didn't touch it. I'd created a kind of phobia for myself, and I feel like a lot of people do that. I needed an incident, something, a trigger to push me over the edge to get me to start playing again, and it ended up being two pianos, four hands.
That's amazing. Did it come back? Did you have to literally learn how to play, or was it like riding a bicycle?
It's not.
You know where
exactly,
the fingers go.
Not exactly like learning how to or relearning how to ride a bicycle, but there's some elements that started to come back. I had those aha moments. Oh yeah, that's right. That's right. This is how it works. In fact, there's a scene in the very beginning of a play that kind of mimics that experience where the two young men forget how to play, and they all of a sudden their hands take over, muscle memory takes over, and starts like doing it for them, which I had to get out of my own way to let happen for myself when I was learning the music for the play. Our director, Tom Fry, who actually used to perform in the play for and has been involved with Two Pianos, Four Hands for about the last 15 years, he's played both parts, Ted and Richard, I think in total of about some 800 performances, and now directs. He's the resident American director for the production. But he often says, we talk about there's two different types of memory. You know, there's the muscle memory and there's the conscious memory. And muscle memory actually sits in a part of our brain that is divorced from our conscious attention. So when we're playing and we let our conscious memory, our conscious attention come too much into what we're doing, we can completely forget where we are. You know, so you have to trust that the muscle memory, that your hands actually know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And your conscious memory mind could be somewhere else. It could be in the moment. It can be connecting with your piano partner. It can be connecting with the audience. It can be connecting to your emotional experience that's happening. But if you let your conscious attentions really focus too much on what your hands are doing, you'll lose your way.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. I really do.
You know, so coming back to it, the muscle memory proved to be the most valuable piece for me in learning how to play again. But it definitely, this piece got me back to where I feel like I was and then raised me to another level because of the, not only the quality of the music, the intensity of the performance, and getting to play that much. I mean, what a privilege to be able to play on these instruments on a regular basis, both in the rehearsal process and every day in performance. I mean, in this case now, I just feel totally blessed to have two gorgeous 9-foot Steinway concert grands.
Steinways.
They're just amazing instruments to play on. And when you're playing on a vessel like that, it just raises you to its caliber in a particular way that you want to honor and keep practicing for and getting better for, you know.
Your partner who plays the other, you play Richard.
I play Richard,
And the fellow who plays Ted, did he go through the same kind of process?
Poor Darren Dunstan. This is his first time on with the show. I've been involved for about a year and a half now and have done several other performances. But Darren came on with a very truncated rehearsal process. But he is an original Toronto native. So Two Pianos, Four Hands is very close to his heart, as is originally a Canadian production.
Mm-hmm.
But he came in phenomenally well prepared with the music. His mother is a classical pianist and helped him prepare for it. And I believe, you know, he's been working on music for quite some time. And it was a pleasure to have him come in and be so well prepared, because it's when you have a partner of that caliber as well, it helps you rise to your best self.
What's so Canadian about this play? Are there geographical references, or do people have to say
we have maybe a sorry here and there. I try to slip in a boot every now and then.
Excellent. The diphthong, yeah, the great Canadian diphthong.
But I mean it's Canadian in the sense that Ted and Richard were Canadian, and this is where their play originates. But the play is since its incarnation about almost 20 years ago now, has played all throughout the world on, you know, several different continents, had national tours all over Canada, several national tours here in the United States, played off Broadway for a number of years, been to Japan, England, and I think they have plans to go to China in the coming year for a production as well.
Your production that you're in, are you on the road, or is it a local production here in the Bay?
The show is pretty well, controlled by Ted and Richard and the parent production team. Just because the quality of the music has to be to a certain caliber, they like to, I guess, keep a hand on it a little bit. So, you know, I've been around with the show.
Good for them.
As one of the American members for, like I said, the past year and a half, and hope to stay on with it for some time. It's been a lot of fun to stick with and have the opportunity to get my chops back up.
It sounds like a great story and a great backstory about you, like not having access, not letting yourself have access to the piano. And then did it just come back?
You know, when I first started doing it, I almost couldn't play anymore.
Wow.
And I had turned on the even the audition five or six times. And finally, Tom Fry, the director, had me come in and said, you know, you just play whatever you can play. And I, you know, I played Francis Poulenc's the 12 movement Perpetuel, and which is a piece I, you know, I loved. It's very simple that I learned to play as a young man, and when I finished playing, I looked up and they're nodding. I was like, oh no, I'm in for it now.
You know? It's a virtuoso comedy, two pianos, four hands by Ted Dykstra and Richard Greenblatt. It's being performed at the Mountain View Center for Performing Arts, 500 Castro Street at Mercy in Mountain View. It is showing now, and it will until February 15th. You may go to TheaterWorks, TheaterReWorks.org. You may telephone 650-463-1960 for tickets and information. Christopher Tocco, a pleasure.
Likewise, Kevin. Thank you for having me.
Privilege to welcome back to KLW our critic at large, Peter Robinson. Peter.
Hi, Kevin. Good to be here. And what a full range you've had today. We've gone, if I've got it right, from Amadeus to Noel Card, and then we've moved into the rhyming pianos or the challenging pianos. So it's almost on a serious note. I'm going to begin with a review of The American Sniper, or An American Sniper, which I think is Clint Eastwood shooting a movie at the top of his game. And I think it's strange to say this, that you can produce a patriotic movie, which is also an anti-war movie at the same time. I think it's an interesting contrast. And playing the American Sniper, Bradley Cooper really turns in, I think, what will be a Oscar-competing performance. And it's a good year, incidentally, for male Oscar competitors or competitors, since Benedict Cumberbatch in The Imitation Game is also going to be a hot number. Now, this story really contrasts the domestic war when the sniper comes home to the war in Iraq, where we see American SEALs and troops clearing buildings in Ramadi. And you've got that sense, which I think any filmmaker really envies, where the opening scene is seen through the telescopic sight of a sniper's rifle, and it focuses on a young child, maybe 4 or 5 years old. He is being given a grenade by his mother, and in the background, a American tank is rolling down the street. And suddenly the sniper is going to make one of those snap decisions, the decision, do you kill the kid to save the tank, or do you let it go? And I think that's really, when I say Clint Eastwood at the top of his game, it is like a filmmaker looking through the lens of a camera and deciding what information to include. And one of the remarkable things about this film is that it's almost non-judgmental in its analysis. So you see the scene, you see the troops together, and the next thing you cut back to Texas, you're in a household where the wife, a lovable wife played by Sienna Miller, wants the husband home. She wants him to be a husband. She wants him to be the father of the kids. And what you begin to discover are the ingredients that go to make up traumatic stress disorder, and how this can affect a family, even an experienced sniper who, in this movie, has 140 recorded death shots, probably in real life, maybe as many as 200. So it's a film I would highly recommend, and I think you want to see the filmmaker's history behind this, because Clint Eastwood started off with the Spaghetti Western. We moved into Dirty Harry. We then had a revenge movie in The Unforgiven. And now we're back on the streets of Iraq. We're back with those troopers. And the theme of protection What is the justification for a spiker? The justification is that he's saving the lives of others. And I think in that context, one goes back to the story which is told at the very beginning of the movie, that the world is made up of sheep and wolves, and then there are the sheepdogs, the people who protect. So I think this is going to be a contestant now for one of the many Oscars it's been nominated for. At the end of the screening that I was at, the whole theatre was silent, and they threw up on the screen the true story that this particular sniper was killed on a range by a fellow veteran by mistake, and then we cut to a full-colour parade where the motorbikes and the flags are out and the coffin is moving down to the final funeral. So to me, it's a very, very moving picture. It's a moving picture that hits you in the gut. It's essentially, as far as I can say, a true story. It does not debate the war. It debates the role of a sniper. And it is both, I think, extraordinarily patriotic and at the same time an anti-war movie. Two thumbs up for An American Sniper. So now for something totally different, as they say in Monty Python. And that theme music takes us into the Mostly British Film Festival. It is running for a week. It starts on the 12th of February, runs until the 27th. And you can see 26 different films, films you won't normally catch playing in the Bay Area. A little bit about the venue. The venue is the Vogue Theatre on Sacramento Street. It's one of the great historic movie houses in the country. It's been carefully preserved. In fact, I always smile at one particular evening I was there. Halfway through the movie, an old boy sitting next to me was scrounging around on the floor, and I said to him, "What's up?" He said, "I've lost my candy." So I said, "Well, haven't you got another piece?" He said, "Yes, but they haven't all got my teeth in them." And I think about that today, because that is the true story of the Vogue Theatre. The Vogue Theatre is really a wonderful place to go to see movies, and the opening film here at the Mostly British Film Festival is called 71. It's set in Northern Ireland. It's at the time of the Troubles, and it's about a squaddie, a British soldier, who gets detached from his unit. So it's in many ways a conspiracy theory. What happened to him, and where did it go? On the second evening, which is February the 12th, I'm introducing the Mostly British Film Noir Evening. And this has two very interesting contrasting films. One is called I, Anna, and it stars Charlotte Rampling and Gabriel Byrne. It's a woman, a divorcee in her 50s, who believes in speed dating, and suddenly a detective is on her case. The detective, of course, is played by Gabriel Byrne. So it's interesting contrast. And the second film that evening, one of my favourites, A Man in Havana, starring Alec Guinness. A story about a vacuum cleaner salesman who gets suddenly wrapped up in the spy world at the end of the Cold War. It's the closing days of the Batista regime. And people may not notice it, but Noel Coward, who we mentioned early on this evening, plays a secondary role. So you've got a really great black and white movie. A little bit of history involved because it's that changeover period. And, of course, once a day, Cuba is very much back in the limelight, and we will hopefully be seeing new or different relations with Cuba. Among the other films coming up is A Man Who Did Give a Damn, and I'm talking about Leslie Howard. This is the story, or the background story, a documentary on Leslie Howard. He did end up in Gone with the Wind. And so you get a very different type of film. And there is a special three-day evening where visiting the city live and to talk about his movie background is Malcolm McDowell. We're running the movie If. We're also running Aces High, which is a First World War anti-war film. And he will be doing an interview at the Century Club. So there's a chance to see Malcolm McDowell in the flesh, as they say. Three or four other films worth talking about. One is based on the life of Winnie Mandela. It's a South African movie, and again, a tribute to somebody who has seen history change, even in her own lifetime. And a couple of interesting small films, which I would highly recommend. One, a black-and-white film called The Battles of Coronel and the Falkland Islands. This is not the recent war in the Falklands in the 1980s under Margaret Thatcher, but it takes us back to the First World War. So if you're interested in seeing very different types of film, 27 in a one-week period, check out the website for mostlybritish.org or call the Vogue Theatre. And you will need to make advance reservations because a lot of these are already filling out. The festival starts on the 12th of February. That is the opening evening. It closes on the 27th. And finally, a series which now begins its last life, its last series, Series 9 of Foyle's War. And people may remember Foyle's War, the detective who really gave a sense of humanity to police investigation work during the Second World War. Well, now the story has moved on, and we're now in post-war Britain. The year is 1946, 1947. It is the beginning of the Cold War, and Foyle, who really was an honest, straightforward detective, suddenly finds he's now enrolled in MI5, that is the British Security Service. It's the world of dirty tricks, dirty operations. And I always said with MI5 that ethics is a county next to Sussex. And so what we discover when we're dealing with the British equivalent of the CIA is all matters are below the table. So Foyle brings his sense of morality to a world which I should say a little bit about post-war Britain. It's the first years of the Labour government. It's the years of ration books. So one of the things he has to investigate is the black market, where all sorts of supplies from nylons to food were restricted, except if you could get them from other sources. It's the world of Russian spies. Russians are crisscrossing the whole of the London scene as the Cold War began to evolve. And then finally, in a real sense, it's the world of what I call mixed morality. His one faithful servant, Sam, is still in the picture. She's now married to a Labour MP, and she is played by the actress who has that wonderful name, Honeysuckle Weekly. If ever you wanted a name for a female actress, that certainly takes the biscuit. So this starts screaming in the first week of February. It goes out as a part of Masterpiece Theatre in the month of May. It's Series 9. It is the end of Foyle's War. Highly recommended, particularly for those who like Michael Kitchen, who has one of those faces that you could live in forever. So there you have it for this week. It's a full run of different events from the American Sniper, the Mostly British Film Festival, and then don't miss your screening of Foyle's War.
My thanks to Peter Robinson, our critic at large. My thanks to all my guests, and my thanks especially to Neil Swinkels, producer of today's program. Open Air, heard Thursdays between 1 and 2 in the afternoon, normally hosted by David LaTulipe. Good afternoon, I'm Kevin Vance. Thanks for letting me keep you company. If you missed any of this, you can go to the KLW website and search for Open Air and all the information that we passed on to you. You can find there on the website. Good enough. Stay tuned for BBC NewsHour.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, we explore Afro-Latino identity.
I didn't see my mom cry, not even once in my life. She always had a minute in the day to dance and laugh and talk to us about God. I don't know. She's magic.
Including a conversation with the Afro-Spanish flamenco singing sensation, Buica. this week on Latino USA.
Latino USA, tomorrow afternoon at 1 p.m. here on KALW. BBC NewsHour is coming up next. It was recorded an hour earlier for broadcast at this hour here on your listener-supported public radio, KALW, San Francisco 91.7, KALW.org. It is 2 o'clock.